confident that I'll be able to present it as passionately as I feel it, especially this lesson. So, if you will, turn your Bible to Deuteronomy chapter 6. I've looked it up. It's page 127 in the Pew Bibles, or at least the two I looked at. And I'll be reading from that very version, the New King James, that might be helpful. I will not have, as is typical, all the text up on the charts. It will be helpful for you to see them in your own Bible or on the page in front of you. As far back as the 3rd century A.D., that's the 200s if I remember right, there was a counting by the Jewish rabbis and scholars of the number of commandments found in the Pentateuch, the Torah, the 5 books of Moses that begin the Old Testament. And we'll be reading from that this morning in Deuteronomy. Their count came to either 611 or 613, depending on whether you made fear of the Lord or Jehovah is one, a command, or just not. You got to believe that the Lord is one, that for example. But anyway, 611 roughly. And those were composed of 245 positive commands, that is, you shall do this, and 365 negative commands. And so they actually, with their numerology, had decided that that first number, 245, was how many body parts there are. So you'd serve God with your whole body. And you can guess what 365 stood for, and that was the number of days in a year. So you just serve God with your whole body all the time. That was kind of the idea. And that numerology meant quite a bit to them. It was expanded on through the next few centuries. And the book is called Sefer Mitzvot Gadol. I think it dates to the year 1200 and something. Anyway, where all those commands are found. And they have to do with the commands and statutes and testimonies and judgments that are found in the first 5 books of the Bible. I'd like to read from Deuteronomy 6 with that kind of a thought in mind. Remembering this is Moses in his last few days on the earth, speaking to the Israelites spread across the plains of Moab, waiting to go into the promised land. Moses is encouraging them to keep the law. Parenthesis, back in June, Sewell preached a lesson on what does Moses say to the next generation or something like that to keep them faithful. It's in June. Look it up. I will not claim at all that this lesson is a re-preaching or correction. I don't aspire to that. It is at best a footnote to that lesson, but I encourage you to listen to that if you don't remember it or if you haven't heard it yet. And then this will just be a tiny footnote to what was said in that lesson. Close parenthesis. Deuteronomy 6. Now this is the commandment. These are the statutes and judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over, that you may fear the Lord your God to keep all his statutes and commands which I command you, you and your sons and grandsons, all the days of your life, that your days may be prolonged. Therefore hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you. You may multiply greatly as the Lord God of your fathers has promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength. These words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and talk of them when you sit in the house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Now down to verse 17. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God, his testimonies, his statutes, which he commanded you. You shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may be well with you. You may go and possess the good land of which the Lord swore to your fathers, to cast out all your enemies from before you, as the Lord has spoken. When your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is the meaning of the testimonies, statutes, judgments, which the Lord our God has commanded you, ... And we'll look at the text later. But that's a question that Moses anticipates that will be asked. Perhaps because of the emphasis on how many laws there are and how detailed they are and how cumbersome some of them are and how costly and how gory and other things that some of these commandments are, he anticipates that in the land there will be a generation that is asking these questions. I often make this point in a different way, but I think we should understand that the Pentateuch, the five books, are a single story. When we were studying the genre of Bible literature in our How to Study the Bible class, the question was, you know, a couple of sample texts. You look, here's the Ten Commandments. Here's a narrative about Korah's rebellion or something. And you ask the question, is this narrative, is this law, is this discourse, is this poetry, whatever. You understand all of that's in the Pentateuch, all of it is. But in a sense, it's a story from beginning to end. It starts with the creation and it ends with the death of Moses. And in that story, there's a record of Moses giving laws. And when you read them, they look like laws, right, and commandments. Or a song that he wrote, it looks like poetry. But really the envelope of the entire five books is a story that begins really with the creation and then disobedience. There's a cycle of man's decline, right? In the descendants of Cain down to the flood, and after the flood to the Tower of Babel. And in that great kind of two cycles of destruction and judgment and so on based on man's decline, God goes to, in chapter 12, a man named Abraham. And in a sense says, I'm going to fix this for good. And he makes promises to Abraham in chapter 12. And so, after the promises and journeys and other things happen, the Israelites, the chosen people, not that they deserved it, but were chosen by God, are exiled in Egypt to a strange and evil land. Now then, in Exodus beginning, the deliverer, Moses, is selected and he's empowered to deliver them out of slavery. And they are delivered. And they begin a journey that lasts some 40 years through the wilderness. Beginning that journey, though, there was a covenant made with God, with Jehovah, things that he would do for them, things that they would need to do in obedience to him. However, through the 40 years and then on through Israel's history, beyond the bounds of this Pentateuch story, there is this cycle, as you know, if you study Judges especially, of disobedience, punishment. And in a way, God often restarting. I think tonight, if you listen online to Philip's lesson, you'll hear a lesson from the book of Isaiah that talks about this prophecy of an exile and return to the homeland. Look for that. But it's just part of the story, repeated cycle and theme of the Bible. And finally, and I would just notice that that's consistent with the way the whole story started in the book of Genesis. And finally, they're on the doorstep of this promised land. And the promised land is flowing with milk and honey and full of rivers and so on. And in some ways, it's kind of like the promise that Abraham was made back in the book of Genesis. So it links that. And that's the way Deuteronomy ends. And the promised land itself really almost links to the Garden of Eden. I won't cover all these, but just notice the similar language in Genesis and Deuteronomy, the description of the promised land that Moses gives here in this last sermon that he gives to the Israelites there on the plain of Moab. The tree of life was in the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And that's what Moses sets before them, life and good, death and evil in his sermon with an admonition to stay faithful. Although, and I may say this again later, if you finish the book of Deuteronomy and get to chapter 32, he pretty much says, but you won't do it. And here's what's going to happen. You'll be taken into captivity by a land that you don't know, by people that you don't know their language and those kinds of things. But anyway, given that he, in a sense, they have returned to the promised garden, right? The promise to Abraham, but even a looping back to the story of the Garden of Eden as they look to the promised land. Before I keep going, the relevance to us today is that we understand by the New Testament revelation that these things happen for our learning. That these are shadows of the journey that we're on. Having been created and having sinned, God chose us, redeemed us, gave us a covenant, and we are on our way to the promised land. And you can see similar language in Deuteronomy just quickly to prove this, and I'll not even read these. The charts will be online afterwards if you're interested. To see that all those words that Moses used to describe the fortunate state of the children of Israel also refer to us. And in some ways, we're only a dim shadow of the bright reality that we enjoy today as the people for God's own possession, right, who look forward to sharing in his glory. So we can learn from Deuteronomy because we are a special people with which God has made a covenant and to which God has given commandments. Now, back to our question. When your son asks you in time to come, saying, what Now, you probably have learned from our How to Study the Bible that oftentimes to translate a text, you have to fill in some English words because they're really not in the original language, in the Hebrew or Greek. And you need that for our English minds to make a complete sentence out of it or to understand what it is. And you understand that is the meaning of is found in italics in the Pew Bible, I hope, but in my New King James Version means that that's really not in the Hebrew. Strangely enough, there's just one pronoun. It's called a pronoun interrogative, and it's called ma. Maybe it's pronounced meh, I don't know. But anyway, let's call it ma this morning. It's just almost like a ba, you know, almost like a just almost a sound that would be made, and then followed by some either verb or noun that just makes that thing a question. So it's kind of like testimonies. If we put our English question mark in there, that's the way it would be. Here's kind of more detail about that. If you're really interested, there's the Hebrew symbol for it. You notice it's fairly short, pronounced ma or meh. It's called a pronoun interrogative. It's an indefinite. And it's the Hebrew question mark, I would say. It begins a sentence often. And it is found many times. I think if you add those numbers and all the others, it's 900 or 1,000 times. And who is surprised at that? How many questions do you think there are in the, you know, in the Old Testament that have to have that kind of an introduction to say, this is a question? 405 times it's translated what, depending on translation, of course. Over 200 times why, almost 100 times how. But it's also translated where, which, who, how long, how many, how often. You see, it's just a question. It's introducing the next concept as something that someone is asking about. Here's some examples, and I just kind of started at the beginning and, you know, ran out of energy after. I couldn't do all 1,000 in the sermon, but I thought I'd do a few starting in the book of Genesis. God called all the animals, or put the animals in front of Adam, to see, meh, or ma, he would call them, right? What? So that's kind of, that's that word. To Eve, when God comes down and he finally gets them out of their hiding, he turns to Eve and he says, what done? Right? They've done something. What is it? To Cain, he says, why angry? And later, after he killed Abel, he says, what done? See, why and what are mixed there. Interesting story in Genesis 12 where Abram at that time goes down to Egypt. And remember, he tells the Pharaoh that Sarah is his sister. Remember that story? And anyway, Pharaoh just finally discovers what he's done to him and what it might mean in terms of the consequences if he marries this man's wife. And he says, ma, this. Like, what? Big question mark. Why? Same word. Why to me done, right? Ah. And then, ma, did you say she is my sister? You see? So the point is, this is a more general open question than kind of like, what is it, or something. It kind of has a fuller meaning that's about why and what. And so there are similar questions that we can see in Israel's history that Moses anticipates will be asked. For example, well, Exodus 16, the Israelites come out and there's all the white stuff on the ground. And guess what they say? Ma, meh, or whatever they say. And because it says in that same verse, they didn't know what it was. And they're kind of asking not just why is this here, or what is it, what's it for, what's this all about, what are we supposed to do with it? And the text that follows kind of explains a lot of that stuff in the way that Moses does. And Moses kind of surprises them. This is bread from Yahweh, is what he says. In Joshua 4:21, the gathering of the stones, ma stones. That's the Hebrew. And he's going to say, what is this pile of rocks here about? And then, of course, in Exodus 12, this is the night of the Passover, the blood on the doorposts. And the commandment is, you know, in the future, you do this and your children are going to say, ma service or ma activity. What are you doing painting the doors with blood? You see what I mean? It's a rich question. So let's look at the question again. The son is likely to ask what, why, how, when, which, what, what's this all about, so on. And so the translators probably rightly are translating it, what is the meaning of, but that may even be too narrow. And then the list, the testimony, statutes, judgments. And you'll notice, and you probably did as we read it, that there's a lot of different words used for the law in this text. Probably five or six different words, and I'm not sure each one has a special meaning. It just emphasizes there are lots of things. There's guidance, there's verdicts, there's judgments, there's ordinances to follow, commands to be obeyed, and prohibitions to be avoided, and so on. And you know, this is a common phenomena, isn't it? In the picture, it's not the fathers asking the sons, what did all this mean? It's the sons asking the fathers. Does that ever happen? I have some grandkids. Some of them are to the point where they're most frequent response to anything is why. You've had that experience? And no matter what answer you give, you know what the next thing they're going to say is? Why? You know what I mean? There's kind of like more whys. Well, what'd you do that for? Well, I'm going to do this. Well, why are you going to do that? So there's this sense of curiosity, I think, that children have. And there's no evidence that God or Moses disapproves of that, right? He's saying they're going to ask you this. That's not bad. They need to be asking these questions. They're growing up. They need to understand the world. They're trying to piece things together. So it's a valid question. The danger comes in that as we're growing up, we often have this tendency, first of all, to discount any of the wisdom of former generations. Those that are reaching their teens are probably wrestling with this. This is hard to believe, but I did. I grew up in the 70s when the hippies questioned everything. They were just dropping out of society. The presumption was that, you know, more or less the authority, I think what was it called, the establishment in those days, had just made a mess of things and we need to start all over. There's nothing really there to save. And so countercultural and those kind of things came along. Maybe it's not quite as severe today, but I think there's a common phenomena. It's probably made worse by the subjective view that everybody figures out truth for themselves. That wasn't quite as strong at the time. There was more of a belief in absolute truth. But nowadays, you just got to figure it out for yourself. And so my questioning is less about discovering the wisdom of the ages and maybe more about feeling my own independence, figuring out things for myself, being my own person, and so on. So that's a danger that comes with this. And the presumption behind that is, of course, that every age is better than the last. That was shown in the story of the Pentateuch, isn't it? Each generation is better than the last. No, wait, it was the other way around. There was always a decline. Each generation was less moral, less orderly, less faithful to God. And it's often the case, I mean, I'm just asking you this, some of you kids that maybe are questioning things about your faith, are you trying to be more rigorous and more conservative and more faithful and more fanatical? Or are you trying to kind of relax the rule a little bit? So there's a kind of a tension there that comes with this question. So a good question, anticipated by Moses, it ought to be asked. But there's dangers that come with it because it may reflect a kind of a growing desire to be independent and a neglect of the wisdom of the past and the false belief that things always get better. That's just backward. It doesn't work that way. And you can see that in the book of, well, in the Bible throughout. So there's the question. Look at verse 24. And this is the first answer I'd like to talk about. And it might be the answer you expected, especially if you're a young person. The Lord commanded you to observe all these statutes. By the way, the question's in verse 20. So I'm going to look at the following verses, and then we maybe expand and look at the rest of the chapter. The Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes to fear the Lord our God. So the first answer is just fear the Lord. He told you to do it. Look back up at verse 2. That you may fear the Lord and keep all His statutes and commandments which I command you, you and your sons and your grandsons all the days of your life. Well, that's probably the answer you expected. That's the because I'm the mommy answer, right? As I don't have time to stop all the why questions, I'll just stop it right here and say, look, I'm in charge. I know more than you. And the fear of Jehovah, you could think of it as terror. And you could kind of look back at the 40 years of wandering at Nadab and Abihu and Korah and a bunch of fearful things. They ought to have been afraid. Mount Sinai comes to mind, scared them to death, right? That's kind of the idea of the fear. But I wonder if there's not a little bit more here suggesting a humility before God's wisdom that stretches from the end of time to the beginning of time to the end of time. His power that allowed Him to create the world, the beginning of the Pentateuch story, that brought you out of Egypt and all of that. So maybe this fear is a kind of respect that says maybe I should listen to what he's saying because of his characteristics. Maybe he's smarter than me. Maybe he knows more than I do. And maybe I should listen. I think that may be more the idea. But surely, that's the answer we expected. I'm God and you're not. That's one idea of an answer. Reading on in verse 24, he says, which I command you this day for your good always, that he may preserve us alive as it is this day. And that's an additional point, isn't it? There are some people that are really smart and powerful, but they're not all that good. And they don't have my interest in mind. I always remember the often quoted C.S. Lewis line in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where the children ask, they hear there's a lion, a huge lion, and they say, is he quite safe? And the answer, I think, of Mrs. Beaver is, who said anything about being safe, but he's good, right? The idea being that God has our interests in mind. That's helpful to know, so that in the fear of that wisdom and power, there is also this understanding that, hey, look around. How did we get to where we are in this great place, having conquered Sion and Og and the Egyptians long before that, on the verge of this promised land flowing with milk and honey? All of us alive here today. So that's a good answer, too. And I suspect you maybe would have probably thought of those answers first. I think that those are good answers. I'm God and you're not. You should do what I say. And by the way, I have your best interest at heart. You ever worked with someone or talked with someone that you deeply respect and you really want to learn as much as you can from them, maybe imitate them in some way. I'm picturing a job maybe as a carpenter's helper, right? And you're watching this person, he pulls out these boards and he does these weird things to them. You don't really understand it at all. And you say, why do you do that way? Or why do you always say this? Or why do you put this over there all the time? Because you can't discern the reasons for it. It doesn't make sense to you. That doesn't mean it doesn't make sense. It means it doesn't make sense to you, right? And here I am looking at this man. And he says, because I'm the expert and you're not. That's not very, very satisfactory answer, right? Or it'll be best for you if you just do this. Now, those are valid. They're true answers. And in case of our relationship to God, they're powerful and righteous answers. But what if the person says, in response to our question, let me tell you a story. Now, I haven't told you the story. How do you feel about that answer already? You like it? Let me tell you a story. What do you think is going to come in that story is something that expands the meaning and the context and the purpose that's behind and the purpose behind these strange things that you are trying to understand. Remember, the question of the sons is, what does this mean? What are they for? Why are they here and so difficult and complicated to follow? And I think we can look back, apart from Deuteronomy 6, earlier, even as they were leaving Egypt, in that night after they had escaped, death of the firstborn, and the unleavened bread, they had their, bread that didn't even have time to rise, and their kneading bowls apparently tucked up in their clothing as they ran out of Egypt. It was kind of the picture. And Moses, under instruction from God, says this, it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers, and gives it to you, that you shall set apart to the Lord all that opens the womb, that is, every firstborn that comes from an animal which you have, the males shall be the Lord's. But every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. If you will not redeem it, then you shall break its neck, and all the firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. Do you see some kind of details in that? And it's kind of gory and probably costly, given this is the firstborn animal and you got to do these things with it. And you might be tempted to ask, which of course is what Moses anticipates, it shall be when your son asks, saying, what? And there's our construction again. Ma, this. What is this about? You will say, because I'm the dad, you have to do it. Because this is for your good. No. By the strength of the hand of the Lord, he brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. It came to pass when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, first person plural, that the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man, the firstborn of beast. Therefore, me personally, the dad, sacrificed to the Lord all males that opened the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeemed. And it shall be as a sign on your hands and frontlets between your eyes. For by the strength of the hand of the Lord, he brought us out of it. You see a story there behind this law of the firstborn, which has lots of details and gore and cost and all that. There's something beautiful behind it. And it's a huge story that puts all kinds of meaning into it. And I believe it helps it be applicable even to other situations. And so, the national story is part of the answer that Moses gives. So really go back to the question in verse 20. Notice the first thing that he says. When your son asks, verse 21, then you shall say to your son, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt. Sound familiar? And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. So the first thing that Moses says you should say to your son is not because God's God, don't mess around. Because I told you so, because it's the best for you, even though you don't understand. He said, let me tell you a story. We were slaves in Egypt, and God brought us out. And he makes the same reference to this deliverance from Egypt in other texts. In chapter 7, verse 8, just the next page over, he says, this is proof of God's love for us and of his chesed, however you say that, his everlasting, covenant mercy for us. This is proof of that, this deliverance from Egypt. In chapter 4, he says, when you go out into the sky and you look up and you're amazed by the planets and how many stars there are, and you're tempted to worship them, wait, stop. Remember the deliverance from Egypt and what God has done in the powerful way that he did that. And that'll keep you from being tempted by the hosts of heaven to worship them. In chapter 5, verse 15, oddly, or differently from the Exodus 20 account, the reason for the Sabbath? In the Deuteronomy account, to keep the Sabbath holy, the fourth commandment, it's because we were slaves in Egypt and we're going to get a rest in this land. What a beautiful picture behind the Sabbath to remember that. Now in Exodus, you remember the reason was on the seventh day of creation, God rested. Interesting that he made that difference. Both of those are stories that help us understand the meaning of the Sabbath commandment. And then in verse 22, the Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes. Again, first person. Great and severe against Egypt, Pharaoh, and all his household. There was deliverance. And he makes reference to those signs in other places too. In verse chapter 4, verse 34, he says, there's really only Jehovah. There's nobody like him. And if you forget that or have trouble remembering the proof of that, think about the powers and signs. Has any God ever delivered a nation like that out of another nation in the way that I've done that? He says there's a uniqueness here. That's the argument in chapter 4. In chapter 7, verses 17 through 19, he says, you're going to be surrounded by a bunch of people. They're more powerful, more numerous than you. They've lived in the land a long time. They're not going to be happy about you coming and taking away their cities and other things. He said, But remember the great signs and powers and wonders. He tells them that story. And as a result of that, don't be afraid of them. Do what I ask you with regard to purifying and purging the land and not making covenants with them. You see how that story of the deliverance helps make sense of the restrictions that he's going to place on them about not even taking the gold or silver that those idols represent or intermarrying and those kinds of things. That's a story that helps us understand that commandment. And then, verse 23, a third point we might say in Israel's story, which we saw in the Pentateuch story slide earlier, then he brought us out from there that he might bring us in and give us the land which he swore to our fathers. A couple of concepts there. One is this is the promise. This is the return to Eden. This is the arc of the story that started at the garden and now ends with the promised land flowing with milk and honey. Right. The second is similar, but related, is that there were promises made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob throughout the book of Genesis. And now, guess what? They're all coming to pass. God makes promises and keeps them. So the story now turns from looking backward to the deliverance and the signs and now looks forward to say, and promises will be fulfilled. And that hope is the reason that these commands have meaning. That we would live and prosper in the land, which is what he has said earlier. And so the story is, and by the way, I was going to say history, the national history. It's not just history. You see why I had to say story? Because story, I was going to say narrative, but that sounded too intellectual. It's the history plus the hope, right? What's coming next is the idea of the story there. And of course, he describes it as large and beautiful and verdant, and you'll eat and be full. In chapter 8, verse 1, he also reminds them, remember, these were the promises that God swore to your fathers. But I think that's, to me, that's huge, what I just said. And when your son asks you, I say this to fathers and mothers, or those of us who answer questions from young folks, and say, why do we have all these commands? They're just so detailed, and they don't seem that important, and they seem, I'm using the youth version of this term, random. That's a frightening thought. Random means there's no plan or purpose behind something. That's the actual definition, right? Mathematical terms, it means every member of the set is equally probable to occur, right? But in actual terms, random means there is no plan behind it. What I think young folks mean when they say random, they mean I don't understand it. A random person or these random laws, they mean I can't understand it. That's a dangerous view. That to think that it has no purpose because you don't. Anyway, the answer is, hey, there's a great story. And it's a personal story. I was delivered personally from my sin, from a life that was destructive. And now I have lived in success. I've lived in the blessings of God because of the change in the commandments. That's my story, right? And there's a personal story in that. And I think the national story is the first answer that he gives. But I think there has to be a personal story that accompanies that. And so again, back to Exodus 13. That night after the deliverance, I think they're on their way. But God tells Moses, set up a memorial for this. And in this case, we're going to talk about the unleavened bread that you got all over the place because you didn't have time to let it rise, right? And so, and now maybe I won't read all this, but remember this day which you went out of the house of bondage and so on. When he brings you into the land, I'm skipping down, you keep this service 7 days, you'll eat unleavened bread. On the seventh day, there'll be a feast. Unleavened bread shall be eaten. No leaven shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters, your house, right? And you know this led to the Feast of the Unleavened Bread associated with the Passover. And we had a connection with that this morning. The story continues in the institution and observance of the Lord's Supper in the New Testament. A lot of details. When you have to do it, how long you have to do it, searching through your house, what you can eat, what you can't eat. And you shall tell your son, again, the Ma word is not here, but it's implied because, it says because, right? So the son says, Ma, this, and then this is done as interpolated. And the answer to Ma is because of what the Lord did for me. Notice now it's not plural, it's personal, it's singular. For me when I came out from Egypt. And it shall be a sign to you on your hand and memorial between your eyes. See that again? Same language we saw. It's in Deuteronomy 6. We read it while ago as well. It's how you see the world. It's something that people see in you. It's so present, it's like a more than a tattoo, which fades, I suppose, and gets wrinkly over time. But no, it's there as a sign. Whenever you do anything, you see it, right? That the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For, again, story, with a strong hand, the Lord brought you out of Egypt. And by the way, there, it seems to me that the answer is yes to the Israelites who are explaining it to their son, but maybe to their sons as well. Do you know why you're in this land of Canaan now? How did you get here? In a sense, through us, you were delivered and put in this place through my grace. So there's a first person story. I was personally delivered. Now look in Deuteronomy 6, and we'll just kind of skip through and just notice some of the things. And by the way, this, if I had to title this part of the lesson, it would be fathers qualifying themselves to answer the question, what does the law mean? Okay? And I think when you ask someone something, and their own personal life doesn't reflect the answers they're giving about the national story, that answer has no credibility. That doesn't mean it can be rejected, by the way, by the young people, but it surely does weaken your ability to tell the story. So I'm saying there's not just a national story, there's a personal story. Look in verses 1 and 2. He's saying, look, this is about sons and grandsons, and we're going to keep his commandments as a family through the generations. That's our purpose as a family. That's our goal on the refrigerator. We're all going to be faithful down to the next generation after. That's a goal. Not everybody find their own way, right? Not let's all grow up to be well-balanced adults somehow or another. successful in the society. No, no. It's about keeping faithfulness to the Lord through the sons and grandsons, verse 2. I should keep this clicker here. Verse 3, we're going to be careful about disobedience. Be careful to observe it. We're going to look hard. We're going to study hard. We're going to understand the language of the Scripture. Right? We're going to spend time as a family, not just memorizing the patriarchs' names and the list of the apostles, but understanding how God has spoken to us in this great story as a personal goal and as a family. And so when I go about to figure out how should I worship or how should I live personally in my life, my morality, I'm going to look carefully at this. This is not just an estimate and I'm not interested in the details. No, no, no. It's a careful obedience. And I'm going to put these words in my heart. If you ask me something, it's likely that some of the language I use and the references I give will be Bible language. It may not even be an exact quote, but it's certainly evidence that these things inform all the way I think about things. The word shall be in your heart. Verses 6 and 8. And not only that, verse 4, which is the Shema, I am willing to accept that there's only one way. Right? You asked me this question. I said, well, you got to figure it out for yourself. Everybody figures it out for themselves, right? Just go search all the world religions you can. No, no, no. We are actually going to be comfortable with the idea that there's only one truth and we found it. We're going to start with that as an assumption. Now, all the evidence is you need to reach that conclusion, but the Lord is one. That's only... There are a lot of different ways that can be interpreted, but it's pretty clear. It's in the context of don't go after all the other idols and the other things that the peoples around you have figured out. It's a statement of exclusivity. And not only that, we're going to have an intentional program of transmission. Verse 7, teach them to your children. Do you notice how much of a reference there is to children and family and sons and grandsons and so on? This text is about the continuity between this generation and the next and the next. And Moses is begging the people, set it up so that we don't have the decline that we've watched throughout this whole Pentateuch story so far. And that's what he's saying. But anyway, part of it is teach them. That way, the Hebrew word there is to pierce. It's the idea that you're going to stick it in there. It's going to be an active activity to put this word to your children and talk of them. And the idea there is to recite. Even sometimes that word is translated to sing. The idea being is not only you're piercing with the concepts, but you're repeating to the point that they might be able to be memorized. And then there's this love for Yahweh. Interesting trivia point is this is the first time that particular phrase, Hebrew word for love, is used to describe men should feel toward God, toward Yahweh. There in verse 5. And then, of course, that love is reciprocated. And so a relationship is formed. And I would describe this to say when your son asks you in that day and you don't have in your life the evidence of your personal relationship with God through prayer, through reverence, right, through conscience, through tears for sin, through rejoicing and obedience. If that doesn't characterize your life, then you've lost credibility in answering that question. Because that's part of your personal story. And then there's the profession and practice. Again, we saw that phrase about frontlets through your eyes and signs on your hands. It'll be evident to people the way you see the world, what they see in your body, and even on the doorposts of your house, and even in the gates, suggesting that as people approach my house, or as the gate, the community, what they see, or as they approach my house, as they come into my home, these are evident signs. The law is written there, right? I don't think it's pretty clear from these other references. He didn't mean to paste boxes of scroll scripture on your forehead or on your hand. He means make it part of your life, evident to everyone. You see the world through it. They see it in your life. They see it in your home. They see it as you enter the community, the gates of the city. And finally, there's a joyful celebration of the promises. I say finally, I don't know if that's the last one or not. But anyway, there's a sense that, no, we're headed for a promised land. And that makes everything easier. All the hard things seem not so hard. And all the difficult, tedious, gory, costly things God's asked to do is nothing compared to the blessings we have before us. And remember, those people were kind of returning to Eden the way the story was being told. And we are too. In fact, Wayne made a reference to that, I think, in the prayer this morning, that that's kind of where we're headed, is back to Eden, and that's our story. And finally, in verse 14, the personal, I said finally, finally, in verse 14, there is the sense that I'm going to be personally unique. I'm not going to go after the gods of the peoples who are around you. When my son asks me if he sees that I'm not much different from my next door neighbor with regard to my, firstly, my morality for sure, but my religious conviction, my belief in absolute truth, my practice in life, if I'm not any different from the peoples around me, what credibility do I have to answer this question? And so the part of the answer is the national story, the bigger picture of where, but part of the answer is a personal story that qualifies the fathers to answer the questions of the sons. You see that? What is the meaning of these statutes? Yes, God says, and you're not God. And, oh, well, it's for your good. You know, you don't understand it, but just for, no, there's a story. And God speaks to us in story. I remember in college, a new convert, he'd kind of been converted by a girlfriend, I think, and was struggling, not a surprise. But he said, you know, I just wish you guys follow all these commands. We didn't use the word random the way we use it today, but you follow all these detailed commands. And I just wish you didn't have to read so much stuff to get to it. I just wish there was a list of things to do. You know, that's kind of the opposite of the way some people see the thing. He says, I don't want a list of rules. I just want to read this. But anyway, his problem was he was having trouble figuring out how we got to this, the conclusions about Lord's Supper and baptism and other things. But he was looking for the list of rules. Is there an index here? Like the 611, laws and commands, I can just look it up in the index, right, and find that out. That's not the way the Bible's written, thankfully. It isn't the way the Pentateuch's written, which is full of laws. It's a story. A national and a personal story. And I tried to explain how, of course, I didn't know what I was doing then for sure. But there's more information in the story, just like that expert when we asked a question and he says, let me tell you a story. And what's about to follow is going to be full of meaning and personal interest and things that are valuable as we give an answer. Here are some wrong answers from the text. There are three. One is in verse 12. Beware lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. You know, that's easy to do. Reference to Sewell's lesson in June. When difficulties fade, right? They got food now. They're not hungry in the wilderness. They're past the Egyptians. They've got through the Amorites. When difficulties fade and the good times roll, this is going to be hard. And go read chapter 8, verse 11 on, where he says, you're going to forget all these things as soon as you get in the land and things are good. And that is such a problem for us today. We are so comfortable. Nothing we do results in an instant punishment, right? We're not struggling with any difficulties. Young people especially, given almost everything they need, with this huge expectation that they deserve more even than that and never have to struggle or work or face difficulties. That just seems unfair. That's not the world. But it does seem like that's the way the world is, and it makes us forget. And it's a willful decision. Let's don't forget that. Oh, I just didn't have the right Bible classes or right my parents to give me the right answers or I didn't go to the right church or whatever. You decide to forget the national story, the personal story that you see in others and ought to be in your own life. That's a willful decision, Peter says. The people in his day willfully forgot another story about the flood, right? When they were saying, the world's going to continue as it is. This story they willfully forgot. And the second thing is to follow after. So it's easier to follow after another alternative, some false religion, when you've forgotten the story of the real one. And he says that in verse 14, you shall not go after other gods and the gods of the people around you. And that's where the influence will come from. More and more, we will have to be separate. And then, perhaps the most dangerous, especially for a young person, I think. By the way, this is hard to believe, but I actually was young one time. And I think I went through some of this stuff, right? So I'm maybe being a little cocky about it, but I'm sorry for that. But he says, whatever happens, verse 16, do not tempt the Lord your God as you tempted him in Massa. I don't think the word tempt is the best one. Test may be a good one. But I think we can understand what those words mean if we look at the incident at Massa, also called Meribah. Those two words mean tempted or tested and contentious. And what happened there is they looked at God's representatives, this may sound familiar, and said, I don't think they know what they're doing. They brought us out, Moses brought us out here. Does that ever happen? Young people, they look at those in authority and they're imperfect people, especially parents. More than anything, we see the imperfections in our parents or elders or teachers or Christians who ought to know better because they're so old, like Marty. And they're just imperfect, right? And I complain about that. They're old fogies and they give me terrible answers and they don't point me to the truth and they brought me out here to starve in the wilderness, blah, blah, blah. Right? That's one thing they did, but worse. Look at that text. They asked the question, is God really here or not? Whoa. That's a serious underlying question. It's one thing to not quite understand what God wants us to do. It's another thing to say, I don't think he's involved at all. I don't even think there's anything to this. That's scary. And Moses is saying to these people, don't do that. This is the opposite, I think, of asking the question, what is the meaning of the law? Is to say, I don't even think God's involved. This is too hard, too complicated. And that quote, you may know, is illustrated in Jesus' temple, pinnacle, temptation. It's in different order, so I can't say which number it is. But anyway, you can find that in Matthew chapter 4, verse 7. But it illustrates that Jesus was tempted to do something that made sense. God promised something, kind of in some way. But he said, no, I'm not putting God to the test. I'm not going to question his authority. I'm not going to wonder whether he's really here or not. That's not my approach to things. And so I think we should be careful to say, I think God should be this way, so I'm going to act in a certain way based on that assumption. Okay. Ma this. If you're young, if you're old, ask the question, what is the meaning of our worship rituals? Call them what you want to. Pick whatever word. Why are we baptized? Is the answer because God said, well, yeah. Is it because it's for you? Yeah, it's for our good. Oh, is there a story behind baptism? And I've tried to put New Testament references that say there is a story behind baptism. In fact, it is a reenactment of that very story, Romans 6. I won't go through them all the same. Is there a story behind the Lord's Supper? Is there a story behind prayer and singing that links it to the sacrifices of the Old Testament, which we want to be carefully, meticulously acceptable to God? Reference Nadab and Abihu, for example. Men and women's roles. Is there a story behind that that goes all the way back to the beginning of time? Does that help us understand it? Not only the facts, but also the significance. Personal morality. Cursing men. Do you realize we shouldn't be cruel, kind, racist, whatever term you want to put in there? Why? That's a hard question. James always asks, Black Lives Matter, and then he says, why? Man, what a great question. Do you know why? Because men were created in the image of God. It says that in James chapter 3. There's a story behind that command. You see that? I'm sorry, I need to go back. Marriage and sexuality, is there a story behind that? Go read what Jesus says about marriage and divorce and who should marry and those kind of things. Submission to authority. Holiness. There's a sacrifice. Yokes, unequal yokes, 2 Corinthians 6, refers to some of these same passages we're reading. And then participation in nearly sinful things. Is that sin? This is not sin. Right? Is there a story behind that? Read 1 Corinthians 10. I hope you have just recently in the classes we've been covering. Okay. Here's my application and conclusion. Ask the Ma questions. I'm encouraging that. If you're a young person struggling, please ask those questions. Ask them with the proper respect and fear for God. Don't be like the children of Israel in the wilderness at Massa Meribah. Don't do that. But ask them. They're valid questions. And I would say, learn the national story of the Bible. If you haven't had a family to teach you that, you learn it. Because that's where you're going to find the answers to why it's significant. And even a lot of the details about how to be compliant. Develop a personal story. That will be your response to God. And finally, based on all these great stories that God has given us through His Word, as Deuteronomy says, be careful to observe them. It will motivate that meticulous interest in truth and in practice that God has provided for us. Okay, the first step in developing Your personal story is obedience to God, accepting Jesus as the sacrificial death for the sin that is inevitably in your life. And so based on that, we offer the invitation of Christ to come forward. If you're familiar with what the New Testament story tells us about how all those people obeyed God and His commands to participate in that substitutionary death of Jesus, if you're familiar with that, this is a good time to do it. We have a baptistry that would be available for that. But all the other things that come with that, confessing that Jesus is Lord, that He's risen, repenting of the sins that stand as a separation between you and God and represent rebellion against Him. If you're willing to make that, do it this morning. If not this morning, or if you're online, in any opportunity that we can help you provide, let us know here at the church. We'd invite you to do something in response to the lesson as we stand and sing.
Sing the wondrous love of Jesus, sing His mercy and His grace.